You're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas. Extreme Cities, the Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change is the new book by Ashley Dawson, called A Groundbreaking Investigation by Bill McKibben. Dawson is a professor of English at the City University of New York and also the author of Extinction, A Radical History. Ashley joins us by phone today from New York City. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Antonia. I'm a big fan of your work and really honored to be in conversation with you.
Thanks very much. New York is also where your book begins, with Superstorm Sandy striking the city. But you write that New York City is not alone in its vulnerability, and that all of the world's great cities are sited on or near bodies of water. And you write this has generated a deadly contradiction that is one of the most overlooked facts of the 21st century. The majority of the world's megacities are in coastal zones threatened by sea level rise. Today, more than 50% of the world's population lives within 120 miles of the sea. By 2025, it is estimated that that figure will reach 75%, and that those urbanites are particularly vulnerable to deadly heat waves, whose intensity and frequency are increasing as a result of global warming. And then you go on to describe that this isn't just an issue of straight out what we associate with the weather increases and changes of global warming, but what extreme city means to you. And can you talk about what extreme city means within this context of how we address what are only going to be more surmounting impacts on cities of climate change?
Sure. So I begin the book actually in my own experience during and after Hurricane Sandy. I was living in a relatively elevated part of the city, but working in Staten Island, and many of my students and their families suffered tremendously. And in order to get there, I had to traverse many other parts of the city. I live in a part of Queens, the borough of Queens, and had to go through Manhattan with the downtown area plunged into darkness at night because power was knocked out, and many of the buildings in the downtown area had their basements flooded by the storm surge that Sandy pushed up into the New York Harbor. And then much of eastern Staten Island got flooded, and many people lost their homes, and a number of people lost their lives as well. So the route I had to travel to get to my work at College of Staten Island really showed how cities need to be thought about as places that are not homogeneous, but that are very kind of geographically fragmented and different, but then most of all are economically highly uneven. And so the idea of an extreme city, which is fundamental to the book, is to think about the ways in which extreme weather events connected to climate change are impacting cities around the world that are very polarized economically and socially. And as a result of those social differences, the impact of climate change and the forms of weather that are coming barreling down on our cities are very different. They strike communities, some of which are far more vulnerable. And the rebuilding process after those disasters often is far better for some communities than for others. It can groove inequalities even deeper, in other words.
And so part of the point of the book is that more and more of the world's population is being concentrated into cities. And one reason why is a response to the impacts of extreme weather. But as you write, how a city copes with stratification of race, class, and gender, or how such inequality are left to fester, has everything to do with how well it will weather the storms that are bearing down upon humanity. It is in the extreme city that the most important struggles for human survival will take place. Can you unpack that idea more, both in terms of how inequality contributes to increasing harm that extreme weather brings, and then also looking at this through a lens of equality can help us better prepare for climate extremes?
Sure, absolutely. So although, as you mentioned at the outset, the book starts out in New York City, I really want to think about cities around the world and ask, why are so many people living in low-lying coastal regions? And in order to understand that, you have to think about the history of colonialism. You know, many of today's megacities are where they are because colonial powers wanted to have cities that were on the coast so they could get access to them easily by sea. And they're often also on rivers that coming down from the interior so that, you know, there could be resource extraction from the interior areas. And that kind of history is only developed even more over the last 40 years of neoliberal globalization. So, you know, you get a lot of contemporary commerce that flows between borders actually being carried on these huge container ships that go from one port city to another. And at the same time, as a result of neoliberal globalization, all of these free trade agreements are being put in place that crack open economies in the global south, that often flood them with cheap exports of agricultural produce and push peasants off the land in the global south. Where do they end up? Well, many of them end up in these coastal cities. And now that climate change is beginning to be even more of an impact, people are being pushed from rural areas by climate change itself into cities when they can no longer survive, you know, growing crops. So yeah, people are flooding into cities all around the world, and the vast majority of urbanization is going to happen in the global south for the rest of the century. So it's going to be places like Dhaka in Bangladesh or Lagos in Nigeria, just to take a couple of examples that are really on the front lines. Although, you know, cities around the world, including rich ones like New York, are going to be very adversely impacted, as we know from recent history. Your question about equality and how cities that are more equal are better equipped to cope is a really important one. There's been a lot of sort of studies of the ways in which people cope with natural disasters, both during the event of the disaster and then during the kind of reconstruction process, that shows that places that are more equal, where people can really count on their neighbors and have some kind of really developed connections, social connections to their neighbors, are the places that tend to weather storms best and bounce back from storms most quickly. So the kind of economic processes that are making cities highly unequal, both in the rich world and also in the global south, are really eroding our ability to cope with climate change and the kinds of disasters that cities are increasingly going to face.
Don't you have sort of two issues there? One is how people cope in the wake of a disaster. And as Rebecca Solnit's written in A Disaster Built in Hell, am I getting the title right? Oh, Rebecca's going to kill me that I'm not remembering the title of her book.
It's A Paradise.
A Paradise Built in Hell. Excuse me, man. My brain is in the wrong place right now. Too buried in disasters. A Paradise Built in Hell. Excuse me, Rebecca. How people cope has to do with these relationships, and better close relationships within communities helps them cope in the wake of disaster. However, if you're talking about extremes in inequality, even those relationships can make it almost impossible to deal with the impacts of a storm. So, of course, if we're looking at the impacts of Hurricane Maria or the impacts of hurricanes just in general on cities and communities within those cities that don't have the economic resources to get basic infrastructure back, so to get electricity services back, to get transportation services back, to reach each other after a storm has hit, it makes even, you know, people will do their best. But if they are in such a stratified economic circumstance, it makes it far more difficult to even gain access to the services to help your neighbor with. And so if you're looking at these extremes of inequality, as you're saying, if you have a greater access and resources within the community to start with, it makes dealing with the impact of the extreme storm, it makes the community more able to deal with the impacts of the storm. That just, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. My a colleague, my former colleague, Neil Smith, wrote a wonderful essay about New Orleans in the wake of Katrina, where he says there's no such thing as a natural disaster. In every single stage of a disaster, social inequalities and a kind of social calculus determines who lives and who dies, who suffers grievously and who is able to recover quickly. Yeah, you know, I think you're right, Rebecca Solnit. Her book shows in a lot of detail, by looking at a number of disasters in the past, how people don't end up in a kind of road warrior, you know, hellish world of kind of competition, a kind of Hobbesian contest against one another in the context of a natural disaster. Instead, often people turn to one another and engage in forms of mutual aid. And in my research in New York City, I found that that was really very much the case. After Hurricane Sandy, you know, basically in the day or so after, there were all of these mutual aid efforts that popped up. And of course, Occupy Sandy helped to coordinate all of that. And subsequently, the Office of Homeland Security did a study of Occupy Sandy, saying, you know, this kind of grassroots peer-to-peer form of aid in the immediate post-disaster moment is really the way to go. But then, as you're observing, Antonia, what happens subsequently often really kind of cuts the inequalities even deeper. So we know about the way in which the school system was privatized in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Naomi Klein has written very eloquently about the various forms of disaster capitalism that played out. And I think a lot of the response in New York City following Hurricane Sandy was very much a product of the ways in which social movements in the city learned from the horrible history of recovery efforts in New Orleans post-Katrina. So there was a lot of pushback against that kind of uneven and unequal restoration project and rebuilding project. But of course, we continue to have huge struggles, and what's been happening in Puerto Rico since Maria last fall is unfortunately a horrendous instance of disaster capitalism playing out once again.
Well, and also, I mean, Maria just brings up so profoundly that when there aren't the economic resources there to begin with, the death toll is so much larger. The extreme impacts on human life is so much larger, and that as you're saying, as more and more people are pushed into cities, one because of the impacts of climate change making it impossible to live in more rural areas, but also, you know, many of us consider the movement into cities part of the solution to climate change. We have much less transportation needs. I mean, if you're not taking Uber or Lyft and are instead investing in public transportation, we have transportation needs that aren't as reliant on fossil fuels. We have people able to walk places and ride bikes places, you know, and that a solution to addressing our carbon footprint is to have more people move into cities. So can you talk about that, you know, what seems like a potentially a contradiction, which is that many of us think that it's a good solution to climate change to have more people move into cities, but you're also laying out all of these different ways that being in cities puts us into greater harm because of climate change.
Yeah, no, I mean, I very much want to see urbanization as a kind of dual process that could have very strong benefits, but I also think it's important to sound a cautionary note about the idea of the green city, which is, you know, very much touted today. And New York, of course, is one of the cardinal examples of that. In fact, it's the best example, perhaps, other than San Francisco in the United States, because most American cities were really planned in the post-war period to service fossil capitalism and to have extended highway systems and suburbs. So, you know, they're part of the problem, most American cities, and we really need to think carefully about how to retrofit them. But concentrated cities like New York and San Francisco could potentially be be a solution. However, we need to remember that there are also sites of rampant racism and social inequality, and that in fact it's the 1% within those cities who are responsible for a lot of the carbon emissions, right? So I talk about some of the studies of, for instance, the most carbon-emitting buildings in New York City. And of course, as you would expect, a lot of them are based in Wall Street area or in the Midtown financial district. But a lot of them are also these, you know, huge apartments of the top 10th of a percent, you know, the wealthy people of the city, and also people who don't live here who are buying that real estate as a form of investment. So one of the really important things that social movements in New York City, and I think in many other cities, are doing is to really fight to mandate retrofitting of these one percenters' dwellings and business places so that they emit much less. And so, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that the struggle against climate change in cities is also a struggle for social justice, and issues like gentrification and, you know, police, heavy-handed policing and putting people in cages who are urban populations really are linked to climate change, and we have to see those connections and make forms of solidarity in our movements.
Can you talk more about that, how extreme policing is linked to climate change?
Sure. Well, in the book I talk about climate refugees specifically, and the way in which people are being pushed off the land in parts particularly of the global south, again, places with a history of colonialism, as well as, you know, these 4 or 5 decades of neoliberal globalization that have pushed people into cities in the global south. You know, what's happening increasingly is that people are being forced off the land by droughts or by conflicts that are connected to droughts or other aspects of climate change, and being pushed into cities, and then sometimes across borders. And of course, that's leading to the rise of these xenophobic right-wing discourses in rich countries like the countries of the European Union and, to a certain extent, the United States, although, you know, our current president won't talk about climate refugees because he doesn't want to admit that climate change is a thing. But, you know, many of the people coming from Central America who he's demonizing are being pushed off the land by conflicts that are related either to the histories of U.S. empire, past and present, or by forms of climate change. And those things really often need to be connected. And many of the technologies that the military and the private contracting firms that work for the military are developing to engage in the war on terror and to interdict immigrants are then also being used and turned around to use on racialized populations in cities in the U.S. You know, so there have been studies, for instance, of the LAPD and how in Los Angeles there are uses of this new kind of algorithmic information collecting technologies that were originally developed to fight insurgents in Afghanistan, but are now being used against historically African-American areas in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, there's this kind of military-industrial climate change complex that we see being developed that's both, you know, bringing down the hammer on climate refugees and also on racialized populations historically in the U.S.
Well, we also saw, and I reported on firsthand from Standing Rock, weapons and military equipment that had been used in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan being used in North Dakota against primarily Native American communities resisting the construction of an oil pipeline. And also, I mean, to your point, there was just a decision handed down this week by the Supreme Court supporting Trump's Muslim ban, which includes blocking people coming to the United States from Syria. And as you write in the book, Syria is arguably the world's first climate change war, you know, making that link again. Let's look at what you describe as radical adaptation. What is that?
Radical adaptation. Well, there are various different forms of adaptation. It used to be kind of anathema to talk about adaptation within the environmental community, right? The argument being that if you start to discuss adaptation, you're taking attention away from mitigation efforts. In other words, you know, efforts to cut carbon emissions. But I think what's been happening in recent years is that, first of all, people have been realizing that climate change is not something that's going to happen in 2100. It's, you know, coming at us right now, and we need to adapt our communities in the United States and in other parts of the world. And also, I think people want to find hope somewhere, and, you know, adaptation offers a source of hope and a sense of futurity, right? So I talk about the Rebuild by Design initiative, which was launched by the Rockefeller Foundation and Housing and Urban Development Federal Agency here in New York City after Hurricane Sandy. But it's since gone national and even global. The Bay Area Rebuild by Design competition, in fact, just wound up recently. So the idea of that was to basically look at a number of sites that were particularly adversely impacted by Hurricane Sandy. We've already talked about downtown Manhattan and Staten Island, and there are a number of others around the city, and get teams of architects, engineers, sociologists to really figure out what a kind of progressive response to that, to the future threats those communities would face would be. And there's some really interesting proposals that have come out. I go through them in a lot of detail. And I also sort of talk about some of the shortcomings. And basically, I found all too often those proposals think about parts of the city in isolation, and they don't really have an environmental justice lens. You know, they don't think about how communities have historically been targeted disproportionately for forms of toxicity like waste transfer stations, bus depots, and other kinds of things that lead to really high asthma levels. So whatever kind of resiliency building and adaptation you're going to be putting in place for the future has to take those kinds of historical ills into consideration. And so radical adaptation is the kind of antithesis to some of these top-down plans that I've been describing, Rebuild by Design and other groups doing. It's forms of adaptation that are proposed by environmental justice organizations and urban-based social movements. And these proposals tend to be much more holistic and to have much more of a kind of broad palette of solutions.
I think that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest today is Ashley Dawson, a professor of English at the City University of New York, and the book is Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Antonia. It's been my pleasure. Okay.